Group meeting, Sunday, 10th July, 1988. There was a God Almighty bang, and manifestation, the whole universe, came into existence. Movement started with that bang. And it's movement which can be either peaceful and harmonious, rhythmic, or it can be a disturbance. But the universal process has shown both aspects in its own development. The evolutionary process consists of the interplay of dualities. Now, we as human beings have to move in a rhythmic, harmonious way. And this is where religion comes in. Because that which is exceptionally prominent in the evolutionary process is the change which has taken place in terms of consciousness. All that lives has consciousness with it. The plant world has consciousness, the animal world, and the human world. And it's a developing consciousness. How does it develop, and towards what is it developing? This is the great thing that we have to discover for ourselves. I have termed this development, the culmination of this development in the human kingdom, as holistic consciousness. And it is religion and religious living which brings about this culmination. It enables this culmination to supervene. There is nothing attained or achieved. This culmination is already there in the primordial creative energy which banged first. So our task is to discover what it implies in terms of our daily living. And it is literally in terms of our daily living. Every single second of the day that we live. Last time we were dealing with the Bhagavad Gita, and we considered this point that the author of the Gita himself is Krishna, the teacher. He himself is Arjuna, the disciple who is listening to the teachings. He himself is one of the perfected holy ones who has realized the meaning and fact and practice of the silence, and he himself is a poet. The author of the Gita is truly a great poet, because the actual Sanskrit is regarded as one of the supreme examples of philosophical Sanskrit in India. Now, I say that the author of the Gita is the teacher as well as the taught. I don't know how many people would agree with me, perhaps none. But there is a verse in the Gita, it's in Canto 10, verse 37, in which Sri Krishna, in that canto, he's talking about himself, and he's presenting himself as the perfection of the qualities of all things that there are. And in this verse 10:37, he says, of the sons of Vrishni, Vrishni is the name of the clan from which he came, I am Krishna. He was named Krishna by his parents. Of the sons of Pandu, I am Arjuna. Of seers, munis, in silence, I am Vyasa. Of poets, I am Ushana, one of the old Rig Vedic poets. Now see what he says. First, his psychophysical name, Krishna. Krishna means dark colored. He came from Dwarka, well, in western India. Then he says, of the sons of Pandu. But Pandu was the father of the five sons, Yudhishthira, Bhima, Arjuna, Sakura, and one other, who were at war with their cousins, the Kauravas, the Kurus. Now, how can this man, supposed to be speaking to this man, Arjuna, call himself Arjuna, and then say that he is of seers in silence, of the perfected holy ones? He is Vyasa. Vyasa means compiler, and his full title is Veda Vyasa. Veda means knowledge, but not knowledge in our ordinary everyday sense of the term. The knowledge of science, philosophy, art, the various skills and all that sort of worldly knowledge. It doesn't mean that. He would have worldly skills also, but what Krishna is referring to is this transcendent knowledge of the Supreme Truth, the origin from which everything comes and to which everything returns. The very word religion, religio, is derived from re ligare, which means to bind back to what? To the origin from which everything emerged. The root is lig, meaning to bind, and re means again, to bind back again. And the binding back again, the return to the transcendent, because we all originated from the transcendent, is what we call religious living. So now Krishna says, he teaches, he who serves me unfailingly in the yoga of devotion. Devotion is bhakti, B-H-A-K-T-I, bhakti. He, crossing beyond the qualities, is fit for Brahman emerging, merging back into Brahman. Now, crossing beyond the qualities, what are these qualities which he refers to? You know, the Sankhya philosophy presents all manifestation in terms of the activity of three qualities: sattva, purity, truth, perfection, and so forth. Rajas, which means motion, movement, activity, and tamas, which means darkness, inertia, ignorance, and also evil sometimes. Now, these are the three qualities which are declared to be operative in the whole universal process, the process of manifestation. And crossing over the qualities means that that which characterizes worldliness is put aside. You have gone beyond it to the transcendent. The transcendent has no qualities in our meaning of the word qualities. Our meaning of the word qualities is certain characteristics, certain ways in which one may define what kind of an action or thought one has produced, good, bad, indifferent, evil, whatever it may be. So, it is a case, that's why you have to transcend not only tamas and rajas, but you also have to transcend sattva. Sattva defined in the worldly sense of what is good. Make a success of your business, become a great man, and all the rest of the nonsense which has characterized the evolutionary process, you see. So that good also has to be transcended. The good, the absolute good, if one may use the word absolute, is of course transcendence itself. And you can't describe it. It is beyond conceiving, beyond characterizing. So that is the ultimate good. Brahman means all that. So you become fit for merging back into Brahman when you have transcended everything that characterizes manifestation. This is what Krishna teaches. When he truly sees all apparently separate existing beings as rooted in and proliferating out of the one, he becomes Brahman. That comes in the 13th canto, verse 30. Now, Krishna uses the term, he who serves me. Recall Jesus' statement, no man cometh unto the Father, the origin of everything, except through me. But what sort of a me is this? And does it mean the me which is specific to Jesus the man, or to Krishna the man, the psychophysical being who is giving the teaching, or is it something else? Now, I have explained it as follows. Me, the word me there with a capital M, is the revealed as well as the inexpressible one reality. Whoso is aflame with the pure passion for me is fit for emergence into transcendence. This pure passion which lights up the night and shines through the day is man's love divinized. This divinized love is the real meaning of devotion, bhakti, this burning passion for the Supreme Truth. Burning without destroying, burning by lighting up, by completely purifying, by restoring to the origin itself. The qualities of sattva, rajas and tamas are the threads with which the web of bonded existence is woven. Bonded existence meaning existence which is a bondage. By you, by me. Love divinized unweaves the web, and you and I, made pure, are ready for the freedom of the unconditioned. You cannot strive for the unconditioned. you can become unconditioned if you live the pure life. Because the unconditioned is something the brain doesn't know. You know, Jesus said, for instance, seek and ye shall find. But you cannot seek that which you do not know already. If I have lost my penknife or a book, unless I know that penknife or that book, I can't recognize it when I come across it, can I? You can't find, therefore, that which is totally unknown. And the unconditioned is the totally unknown, the unconditioned. We have to decondition our conditioning, which enables the psyche to be able to be in touch with the unconditioned. Bhakti has a twin, jnana, knowledge. The pure awareness which is being. This transcendent knowledge is not the sort of knowledge which is obtained by an observing subject examining the observed object. It's not that kind of knowledge. It is the knowledge which comes to you through actually becoming, through actually being what you come to know. You see, take for instance this wall here. If you look at it gently, carefully, patiently, persistently, without any sort of reaction towards it, without deviating from attentiveness to it. In course of time, you will become awake to the what I call the wallness of the wall. And when your consciousness of the wallness of the wall becomes sufficiently intense, which is the meaning of what happens in the different jhanas, the intensity of consciousness increases, then you become the wall in consciousness. Not physically, of course. But in consciousness, you become one with the wall. It's an extraordinary experience. Human beings know, for instance, that when they are totally, completely, transcendentally in love, they are speechless. There is no separation from between the beloved and oneself. The two are utterly one in consciousness, in the consciousness of the one who does this. And if and when you find a man and a wife who are both like that, they might procreate Buddhas and Christs. Whoso is quite purified, in whom love divinized burns steady and bright, who truly sees and who knows with the knowing which is being that the many are the one only, he verily becomes Brahman, the absolute all. And this is the culminating point of consciousness for human beings. This is the state of holistic consciousness. That this does not mean, therefore, that you are always in that state of consciousness. You can enter that state of consciousness as and when you please. You know how the Buddha mentions the four jhanas, followed by the four samapattis, and ending up, the ninth thing he mentions, is the cessation of perception and feeling. Now, the cessation of perception and feeling marks this end point, so to say, which is possible for any human organism. that consciousness can function in the context of the eternal and of the infinite. As a matter of fact, the Buddha himself suggests this. I don't claim to have made any original statement when I say that holistic consciousness functions in the context of infinity and eternity. The Buddha himself talks of the fourth jhana, and then he says, with the going down of all sensory perception and feeling. Sensory perception and feeling. That means restricted to the psychophysical organism. The bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the infinity of akasha. Akasha in Indian teaching represents not only space as we ordinarily understand space, the space in this room or outside and so forth, but it represents the totality of the material manifested universe also. Because it is out of this space that the material universe comes. The matter, the stuff of space, it's a funny expression, but the stuff of space becomes all the matter that we know. You know, was it Einstein who said that space, that matter is warped, W-A-R-P-E-D, warped space. Now that's extraordinarily significant that modern science has made that statement. And to me, it is identical with this consciousness that is associated in the Holy One with the infinity of akasha. And then he mentions the infinity of consciousness. Now, the functioning of consciousness is very intimately associated with the passing, the passage of time. So, space and time come into this. Infinity and eternity. Out of time, you die out of time into eternity. I can assure you that this is true. Someday, sometime, if you are fortunate enough, and the Buddha was called Bhagava, the fortunate one, remember, you will experience this kind of thing. The transcending of space and time, which we are conscious of in our worldly terms, our sensory terms, that is completely transcended, and you are conscious in the reality of infinity and eternity. And then the Buddha mentions the state of no thing, which does not mean a complete vacuity, a nothingness in the annihilation sense, in the annihilative sense. It is no thing. That means a separate manifestation of the ultimate reality. Separation is gone. In consciousness. This has been done not only by the Buddha but by so many. And it can be done, and it seems to me that this is the culminating point of human development in terms of consciousness. So now, timelessly, the veiling mists obscuring the perfect holy union of transcendence, heaven and earth have vanished for the time being. I mentioned in the chapter on the Upanishads that transcendence, heaven and earth are in constant unity. That unity we as isolative and separatively conscious human beings are unaware of. I don't know how it came to me, because I was writing that chapter many years ago, and it suddenly wrote itself like that. Transcendence, heaven and earth are a unity. When the breath of grace is stilled, for none may take that air too long, then again sattva and rajas and tamas impose their disequilibrating activity upon the still one, the perfected holy one who has entered that state of the cessation, as the Buddha called it, which the Upanishadic teachers call the Turiya, the fourth state. They used deliberately used terms which hide the real meaning. You know how the Upanishads present the states of consciousness towards the culminating point. The waking state, the dreaming state, the dreamless state, the dreamless sleeping state, and the fourth state, the Turiya. That is wonderfully presented in the Mandukya Upanishad. Don't mistake it for the Mundaka, that's another one. The Mandukya Upanishad makes the statements. I haven't come across any explanation of those statements in the Mandukya statement, Upanishad. Even by Radhakrishnan penetrated very deeply into the Upanishads, or by Dasgupta and various others. So, the return to the ordinary everyday consciousness of sattva, rajas and tamas is a disequilibrating activity. It brings up our human problems, difficulties, joys and sorrows, pleasures and pains and all the rest of it. And the Brahman constricts again into a seeing subject observing separate objects. Otherwise, if that doesn't happen, you are conscious in the transcendent way of the unitary wholeness of all manifestation with the transcendent, the manifested and the unmanifested all go together. You will find Krishna saying later that beyond what is called the unmanifested, there is another unmanifested. We'll come to that later on. The indestructible unmanifest, the last born, reaching which there is no return, is my supreme abode, says Krishna. And he also says, I, the Purushottama. Purushottama means the ultimate or supreme person. Uttama, in the Pali we have Uttara, and the Buddha uses the same terminology. Uttara Purusha he talks of. And the Upanishadic teachers talked of the Uttama Purusha. And Purusha means the person. And in the Katha Upanishad, there is a verse which says that there is nothing higher than the person. Now, how do the Upanishads define Purusha, the person? They define the person as he who has burnt up all evil-mindedness and all evil things. Recall the Buddha speaking to Upaka on the way to Kashi. He says to Upaka, I have overcome all evil things. And Jesus also used the term overcome all evil and so forth. It's very interesting, isn't it? How you find these similarities. So now, Purusha is the person who has burnt up all evils. When the psychophysical organism and the consciousness functioning through that organism has purified itself to that extent, this is the supreme burning up. This is the supreme meaning of the sacrifice of the man. the human sacrifice. You know, they talked of sacrificing goats and cows and all that sort of thing. And they also talked of the human sacrifice, sacrificed the living man. This is the real meaning of that sacrifice. At least I say so. Forgive me if I am wrong. There was the sacrifice of the horse, the Ashwamedha. And this human sacrifice was the Purushamedha. The complete purification of the psychophysical organism by the burning up of all evil. It's the same, I think it is a similar thing to that part in Exodus when Moses, when the Lord God speaks out of the burning bush to Moses. Because what does he tell Moses? Say unto the Israelites, Ehye Asher Ehye. I, Moses, am Asher, that I am, the supreme I am. And the root of Yahweh, Jehovah, and of Ehye is the same root in Hebrew. You see, all this is really the story of man's development, his ultimate fruition and fulfillment. It's an extraordinary thing altogether. In the golden verses of Pythagoras, you find it stated, in the practically the last verse, that when you have gone completely beyond the body, by body he means that manifestation which spells restriction and limitation, then you become a living God. So you see, the God idea is man's, is projected by man. But unfortunately, whilst at root it is perfection itself, the way God has been described by well-meaning theologians and countless other people and believed in is a pettifogging presentation. It really is a pettifogging presentation. I have looked at the God conceptions in all the religions, even including Islam. I say even including Islam because I'm almost completely ignorant of Islam. I have read the Quran through many passages of it, and I found fault here and there. Destroy the infidel. You can't destroy the infidel. You can only love him, educate him, to educate, to draw out of him the divinity that is hidden and suppressed. That is educating. And therefore healing him. To love, educate, and heal. That is the task. Now, Krishna says, I am the abode of Brahman. But in another place, he also says, Brahman is the indestructible, is my abode. Now, how can he be the abode of Brahman and at the same time say his abode is in Brahman? Brahman, the indestructible, unmanifest, the non-finite, the immeasurable, the absolute. Now, how can this be? How can each be the abode of the other? It is so. Realization is in the living content of man's actual experiencing. It is the plenitude beyond count, beyond measurement. Comprehension of this by him in whom evil-mindedness is burnt out is of the nature of an attuned vibration, not distorting the truth. But it cannot definitely grasp and so limit whole reality. Clearly, realization is beyond explanation, yet it has a core of strange logic, or the comprehension and realization would each be separate forever in lone darkness. I've used the word logic here. I should have used the word illogic. This, that which is beyond logic and illogic is illogic. It is illogical. That which has become the self-evident, complete truth for you has no relationship with logic or illogicality. It is illogical. It is so. And you realize that isness by having become that isness. Eckhart's word, Ishtigkeit, is a very good word. Sophia, you know the word Ishtigkeit? Yes, you know Polish. Do you know German?
Polish and Russian.
Yes, but not German. This illogic, I've written logic here, but I would say illogic, makes paradox true. You see the truth of paradox then. And this logic has the elasticity of the living, whereas the purely formal verbal structure has the rigidity of the inanimate. But each to its own place. You want the ordinary worldly logic for proving this, that and the other. In the realm of the transcendent, there is no place for proof. Now, all of us here, sitting here, we know that we are alive, and we know, and we know that each single physical, psychophysical organism is a living organism. It's a self-evident fact. Your experience, we are experiencing it. It doesn't need any proving. It is so. It's beyond logic and illogic. And you see, in the illogical consciousness, there is no such thing as argumentativeness. There is no argument. There is no possibility of quarreling. No possibility of proving this is right and that is wrong. Everything is included in that transcendent consciousness. And the question of which is better or worse or right or wrong just doesn't come. It is there. Look, you take a physical, a human body. Somebody, a man who is very handsome, a woman who is very beautiful. Well, we see the external shape and form and say, handsome, beautiful. But what's inside here? In the guts. Handsome, beautiful? No, we say no to that. But in transcendent consciousness, you won't say no to that. That which is eliminated by any one kingdom is sustenance for another kingdom. Manure from cows or horses or whatever it is fertilizes the earth, which is sustenance for the trees, for the plants, and so on. So you see, nothing is rejected. So when any question arises, why does God allow this, that or the other, if He is a perfect God and a loving God and all that, it just doesn't arise. It's our ignorance which makes us ask such a question. Again, sometimes we feel that we don't want to live anymore. I have felt that myself recently. You know why. But it just has no place in truth. That sort of thing. It is just a reaction against something which was not desired. I mean, again, something, that something which was not desired happened, and therefore this is a reaction. And it's a passing thing, it's a foolish thing. It's a temporal thing. It doesn't belong to the realm of the eternal. So, that is why I have sometimes in our group said, understand the body. Study physiology, it's a very useful study. Because the universal process is very similar to our own physiological process and our anatomy. You see, the human race has unwittingly, but nevertheless by great good fortune, used correct words time and again. For instance, man has been presented as the microcosm. Well, if it is the microcosm, it is the complete counterpart to the macrocosm, the universe. So if you study the universal process, or if you study the body, and really understand the body, deep down in your consciousness, be wholly awake to that entire body, the entire psychophysical organism, you will become the perfected Holy One. The tendency of the female to beautify herself, to titivate herself and all that, is not only for the purpose of attracting the male and ensure the perpetuation of the species. It's not merely that. It is a reflection, almost a shadowy reflection of the transcendent process itself. Because look at the body which is the universe, the body of Brahman. What a beautiful thing it is, what a marvelous thing it is. Also what a terrible, destructive thing it is. Galaxies collide. But you know, their collision is more like a wonderful ballet, because the stars composing a galaxy are trillions of miles apart. And they have no chance of going headlong into each other. And yet, this phenomenon of what we call destruction goes on side by side with construction. That is why I have said recently, again and again, don't shut anything out of your consciousness. Observe it, keep on observing it, without any reaction whatsoever. Whether it be good, bad, indifferent, pleasant, painful, joyful, sorrowful, evil, doesn't matter what it is. Just observe, be at one with it. In being at one with it, you release a transcendent energy which will heal what is evil into good. It will make what is already good, and our good is always in a limited measure, it will make it much better. Until your influence will transcendentalize your total environment. This is what one of the purposes of our existence here as human beings, and one of the things that religion brings about. Because religion introduces the element of the transcendence as nothing else does. Great art does it to a point, deep philosophy to a certain extent. Science to a considerable extent also. But none of them do it like religion. Because religion deals fundamentally with consciousness, with your consciousness, with my consciousness. And in the transmutation of this worldly consciousness into the holistic consciousness, there is the fulfillment of transcendence as humanity. It is transcendence which completely realizes its fruition in terms of a human being. And this is the marvelous destiny which lies before the human race, if only the human race would awake to it. And it is our business, your business, with your environment, with your friends, your relatives and so on. Help them to awaken to this. Don't present it to them on a silver salver, saying, take this. It will only be thrown in your face. Very gradually, quietly, lovingly, sweetly, gently, without any striving, let it all happen. How does love grow up between two people? In the real sense, not the ordinary external infatuation, the desiring, the possessing, and all that sort of thing. How does it grow up? It just grows. It just appears like that. And you can't believe it at first, if you try to look at it with the intellect. But it is there. And it is the divine thing. So you see, don't strive to become Buddhas or Christs or Beethovens or anything like that. Just be yourself. Veda Vyasa knew all this, so he spoke inspiring words. Magical words about the numinous and the unknown in both its aspects, that which comes to one in the condition of revelation, the I am state, when Arjuna is rapt into Krishna. R-A-P-T, rapt into Krishna. And that which remains the unknowable, the transcendent mystery. And he also knew the truth about himself, the man in the world, in relation to transcendence, namely the truth that is fully told in the words, I do not know. You see, the devotee is the true devotee is completely taken up into that transcendent real which he worships. In the Bible you have the phrase, and the manhood was taken up into the Godhead. You know, all the great teachers taught the same thing in their particular forms and ways, because their language was different, their culture was different, the climate was different. In a hot climate you'll talk in one way, in a cold climate you'll talk in another way. You'll probably swear in both climates. Because I have heard Parsi ladies using troopers' language when the sun was too hot in Bombay. So you see, it's like that.